Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. I really thank you so much for joining us here on the program. It's extraordinary that it's an extraordinary pleasure for me to come to you each week to bring you these wonderful conversations that we have with our guests on Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We do stream live at richarddugan.com for the radio show broadcast. We also archive the podcasts at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page, so that you can go back and listen to the interview. But even more than that, you can go back and listen to the rest of the interview, because a lot of times we go longer than the prescribed 50 minutes that we have for the broadcast. We might go an hour. We might go an hour and a half. It really depends upon the guest's availability as we're doing these interviews, and we record the whole thing. And so check out the afterview. That's the point at 50 minutes and beyond. That's what we call the after view. So please check it out at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. Well, here we are. It's 2018. We're all looking at what we can do to make our lives better, to find those new ways of living, as we talk about. We're here to give you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. We also bring you stories that hopefully will inspire, encourage, incite you to make changes in your life, to make those dreams come true, giving you, as we say, those choices, looking for those new paradigms for a new world. And today, we're going to do that again here on the program, as we always do, with the co-authors of The Painting of the Piano, an important, an improbable story of survival and love by John Lipscomb and Adrian Lugo. I want to thank you both for joining us here on the program. It's great to have you all the way from South Florida. I'm actually surprised you're there after what happened to all of Florida. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. We appreciate it.
Yeah.
If I might ask, how did you folks fare as far as this this past 2017 season of hurricanes and double and I think triple whammy across the southern part of the United States from Florida to Texas?
Well, it was. We got hit really by Irma. And we're on the east coast of Florida, so luckily we avoided the worst parts of it. That hit over in Naples and Tampa. But we got hit with about a Category 1 hurricane, and Adrian and I actually rode it out right on the beach right here. And the surge wasn't too bad, and actually the rainfall wasn't bad. But the wind was about 80-mile-an-hour winds, and that's our first hurricane we've been through. So it was a little nerve-wracking. But we survived and without too much damage. We made it through.
There's a story there, probably a book that'll come out of that as well.
There could be.
Now, the two of you have put this wonderful work together. You've each celebrated over a decade of sobriety, which I find it interesting. Normally, from what little I know, because I haven't really done that much research into it, but from what little I have gleaned over the decades of conversing with people, is that usually folks who are in that process, and especially if they're involved in 12-step, there's a great deal of anonymity. You don't necessarily go public per se, but at the same time, if you have made some incredible strides forward in your life, you know, it's like, hey, I can do this and so can you. You want to tell the world.
Absolutely. There's a new wave actually that's come out in the last 5 years. There was a movie called Anonymous People, and really encouraging people to speak out and say, I'm in long-term recovery. And take away the shame that goes along with it. For me personally, I wanted to shout it from the rooftops from day one. I wanted people to know that I was sober so that if anyone else needed help, they knew where to come and could ask me, you know, for themselves or a loved one.
And what about you, John?
Well, pretty much the same. I have 19 years in January and Adrienne will have 13 years. She's coming with 13 years, and almost from the beginning, I've been pretty vocal about it, too. I did a lot of outside work for recovery centers and promoted them, and when we sat down to actually write the book, we had to make a decision that we were really going to break our anonymity, and we said, if we're going to do it, then we're going all out, and so we told our stories, you know, blood, guts, and all, and boy, Richard, the amount of phone calls and emails and texts we get, you know, encouraging us and thanking us for the courage we had to write the book is just amazing. And it's we wrote the book to help people at the end of the day, and that's why we did it. And so we have to be loud and we have to be vocal about it. And, you know, you start off your show so well every time about inspiration, and we've won a few literary awards we've been fortunate enough to, and two of the awards were for inspiration and from what we came through. So we've been pretty vocal. We're not very... No, we don't hold an anonymity.
You're not quiet. You don't sit in the corner and wait for life to pass you by. You're out there doing it. And what I find interesting, too, is, and this is, I'd have to say this is probably part of the challenge that we all face, especially those of us like myself who have never had to deal with that kind, any of these kinds of addictions, quite honestly, because... I was never interested. It wasn't that I've tried it, no, it's wrong, or God will send me to hell, or I just wasn't interested. And I don't even like drinking a lot because I don't like the feeling of not being in control. And especially where I happen to live here in Santa Barbara above the city in the mountains, if there's a fire and I'm intoxicated, what good am I? I'm as good as dead. And so that's another reason why I don't do it. And that's me. That is only me. And it's all also along the lines of I was actually sharing a story of relationships and marriage and that, you know, divorce. Oh, I don't want to do that. And I was talking with a woman who is a divorcee, but I didn't know that. And I was spewing this. And I was in my 20s saying these things, right? And and it's like, you know, you really need to know your audience before you start talking. But I think that for those of us who don't face those kinds of addictions, and I'll bet you that if someone were to, I don't know, run an analysis on my life, they'd say, well, yeah, you're not addicted to alcohol or drugs, but here's some areas where you might want to take a look at. I'm leading to this point, and that is that when we see certain people in our society, whether they be major public figures or minor public figures or private figures that make it into the news, sometimes we will have some empathy for them. And other times, we don't. It's like, nah, they don't stand a chance. No, throw them in the jail there and just lock them up, and because they're not gonna change. You know, they say they're going to change, but and all of that aspect. And yet, everything that I've learned over the years, both through this program as well as through my own process, isn't that part of what, for example, education is all about? We go to school to learn, and we try to get it. We try to grasp it, to understand it, we try to grok it. And we try to move forward. We try to evolve. But when it comes to people with addictions, we don't always have that kind of understanding and empathy. Can you folks, can the two of you address that?
Well, I mean, no one wants to become addicted. You know, for me, being born addicted to heroin, I mean, I believe I was predisposed to it genetically. Mm-hmm. I avoided, you know, I had C-sections and surgeries and really was very aware of my predisposition for it. And it just, you know, a couple more surgeries and a very bad time in my life and a bad marriage. And all of a sudden it became a perfect storm. So, you know, like in the book, we talk about our mothers, and of course, my biological mother was a heroin addict and an alcoholic, and I swore I would never end up like her, and I did. And that's why we try to educate people, the community, that addiction is a disease.
Well, that's what we've been hearing. Go ahead, John. I don't want to interrupt you.
Yeah, I'm just going to tag on to that. It's like, you know, it wasn't on our bucket list to become addicts or go to AA. And, you know, my mother was an alcoholic, and so I fully believe that it's a genetic disease. And I think a lot of it's a lack of understanding, a lack of knowledge from the general public who don't understand, you know, the addicts. And, you know, for the most part, we couldn't help it. We were going to become what we were going to become. And there's so few of us who break the addiction. The percentage rates are 5 to 10% of the people who stay sober for a year. So you're really breaking the odds if you stay sober. And but there's just a lack of understanding out there. And it's easy to blame the person, but you really should be blaming the disease and not the person. And the general public, I don't think, understands that.
Hmm. Well, it is rather astounding that, you know, we go through our individual lives and our cycles, and, you know, we're just trying to make it through. You know, we're just trying to do the best we can with what we've been given. And a lot of times for example, as you describe in your cases, you weren't given a great deal in that respect, as far as that ability to succeed from the standpoint of, as you say, your genetics, you know, I mean, and the way you came into this world. And it's interesting that the two of you found each other, you know, with these kinds of situations. But maybe it's not so surprising, because maybe that was the strangely enough, I don't believe that there are ever any accidents. There are no coincidence. There are coincidence. And so maybe maybe we can talk a little bit about that, as far as how the two of you managed through the melees of all of this, you managed to come together. That's to me, that's rather astounding. Or is it not so much?
Well, I think we agree with you. We don't believe in coincidences. And, you know, we both believe it was fully a God thing, you know, that put us together. And our stories are pretty similar, and we realized the parallels that we had. We both went through big court decisions when we were children, custody cases. Adrian's was much more unique and was carried by the national press, and both our mothers were addicts, and they both died at age 47. So at the beginning of the book, it states, you know, the things that holds us together are the bonds with our mothers, and if we lose that bond, then who knows what happens, and that's what happened to us, and Adrian will kind of explain how we found each other, you know.
I mean, I definitely believe, I strongly believe it was divine intervention. I believe, you know, I went to treatment. I knew I had to get help, and at my treatment center, we went to a 6:30 a.m. meeting every day in Newport Beach. I was there for 90 days, and so we were just riding our bikes to the 6:30 a.m. meeting. And I get home from treatment, and I'm thinking, I'm just going to continue doing what I was doing for 90 days because it was working. And I look in what we call a where and when to see where the meeting, AA, closest AA meeting was, and it was literally the church next door. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I just think God has a funny sense of humor, and I walked into that meeting. It met 7 days a week at 7 a.m., and I walked in, and John approached me, and he said, "You look really familiar." And I said, "Well, yeah, you..." He had a dog fencing business, and I said, "You put in two fences for me." So, I don't know. I think that was destiny.
Well, I honestly do understand better these days, because of my own relationship, about like attracting like, also about universal timing. In conversations I've had early on in our relationship with my present wife, we used to talk about some of the places, especially in my hometown of Phoenix, Arizona, where we used to go. And said, "Well, when did you go there?" And I would tell her, "Well, I was there on da 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 da." And she, "You're kidding! I was there on, you know, either the day before or later that day or earlier or that next day. And I began to kind of piece it together going, okay, well, the universe basically says, okay, let's bring them together. No, wait, not yet, not yet. And a few days later, let's bring them together. No, wait, not yet. And this would happen time and time again until finally, you know, the time was right and away we went. And the same thing with our moving here to Santa Barbara, you know. It's funny, I look back and think, gee, you know, we didn't have to wait. We could have moved any time. Yeah, but would it have been the right time? And I think that that element of right timing, if you will, is, you know, or God's timing, if you will, divine intervention, if you want to put it in that context. And you two have come together. You've put together this wonderful work that is entitled The Painting and the Piano, which is an improbable story of survival and love. You two obviously have survived a great deal. You've been through an awful lot. We can talk a little bit more about that. But what I'd like to do, and again, maybe touch upon, because you do mention, obviously, you've been through 12 steps, so there is in your minds a higher power. Can we talk a little bit about that from your upbringing, if there was even conversation or attendance in any kind of service, a congregation of sorts, and or teachings, or were your lives kind of devoid of that until you got to this place where now you, in the 12-step sequence, the first one, I guess, is to acknowledge that there is a higher power. And I may be wrong with that because I don't know the 12 steps.
So for me, I grew up in a Jewish home that was really not religious. We never really talked about God. It wasn't until it wasn't until I was taken away from my parents and placed with my biological parents in Brooklyn, and I was miserable and desperate. And shortly after I moved there, my grandmother had passed away. So I would talk to her and I would kind of think of her as my guardian angel. And I started praying to God every night, like, please, you know, get me out of here. And then, you know, it just kind of, I think I was just always searching. And then, of course, then I got sober, and I don't know. I've said this at meetings. I feel like my life, I've always been led in a way. It was an innate thing that I knew there was something bigger out there. Mm-hmm. And I just, you know, I've never doubted that. And of course, now working a 12-step program, you have a relationship with a higher power. I meditate and pray every morning. And if I'm indecisive or not sure about something, I turn it over and trust, you know, God's will for me and try to live my life that way.
Well, and I was brought up in St. Louis, Missouri, and I was baptized Episcopal, and that was the end of it. I didn't attend church again until probably about a year before I got sober, and I was almost 40 before I got sober. So I wasn't atheist or anything like that. I just never gave it a lot of thought about God. And, you know, there were obviously those foxhole prayers where, you know, when I was in real trouble, you know, I'd say, God, please help me get out of this jam, and I promise I won't do this again. And, you know, but I never followed through. And so when I first got sober, it was the night before I got sober, I made a call to my ex-girlfriend. And luckily, and I believe that this is all God, is that she answered the phone. If she was out that night, or if she wasn't there, or she refused to answer the phone, I don't think I'd be here today, because I was at a pretty low bottom when I got sober. So it was like my last gasp in reaching out for somebody, and she set up an appointment for me the next day to go to treatment. And I think that was all God's doing. And I was willing and open at that point to accept that. And when I went into treatment, I was kind of hazy for the first couple weeks. But then I had to start looking at the 12 steps and get involved in the AA program. And the first step is, you know, we became powerless over alcohol and their lives became unmanageable. And obviously I agreed with all of that. And then I had to look at the higher power question. And I talked to a lot of friends, and one friend in particular said, I asked him, I go, do you believe in God? And he said, yeah, I do, because I changed where I was completely unable to before. And I thought about that, and I go, you know, that works for me. So I've stuck with that ever since then. That, you know, I tried getting sober on my own, and it never happened. And I reached out for help and to God, and I got sober. Then I had to take on the question of, well, so if I believe in God, then what is God's will for me on this planet? And so I looked around and searched around, and I've only found two things that I know absolutely positively for certain are God's will for me. And number one is that he wants me to stay sober, and number two, he wants me to help people. And if there's more, maybe I'll find it in the future, but for now, I know that that's God's will for me, and so that's what I try and do on a daily basis, and I pray daily. And so I believe in God, and he saved my butt.
I find that interesting also that the two of you who've come together, you're living this wonderful life and so forth. You've made it through this incredible adversity. And it's quite honestly next to, and again, I have no points of reference on either of these examples, but next to probably going through a war, whether you're in the military and fighting it or whether you're a civilian whose home and city and country are in upheaval. I mean, this has got to be, I'm curious as to whether or not there are issues surrounding, for example, post-traumatic stress. I mean, the two of you, you've come out the other side, granted, from, again, my limited understanding, you're still working one moment to the next to maintain your sobriety, to maintain your commitment to yourselves and to each other. Is there anything along those lines with addicts that when they come out the other side, or is it because it's such a gradual process? I mean, it's not boom, boom, you're here and now you're here. That maybe that isn't part of the sequence.
Well, yeah, I'll start with me. You know, I came in at a pretty low bottom, and so I had to learn everything all over again. And everything was new because since the age of 15, I was a daily drinker, and I drank to the point of blackout basically for 25 years. So I had to learn how to do everything over again. But there's a great phrase that George Carlin said. He goes, I got the monkey off my back, but the circus is still in town. And I love that statement. And it, you know, the physical part of the addiction is about 10%. So it's relatively easy to get rid of the physical part of it. The 90% is psychological. And, you know, so there are a lot of, they call them isms in the program. So I have a lot of isms. You know, I don't make the best decisions. So now I have a committee of men who I talk to typically before I make any big decision, because I just don't make the best decisions. So there are things I had to learn how to do differently. And so that's kind of the post, you know, that you're talking about for the most part. I had to relearn how to do things and to do them the way normal people do them. And so I don't trust myself. I talk to a lot of people before I make any decisions. I talk to a lot of people on a daily basis just to stay in check. And I have a sponsor who knows me inside and out and knows every gory detail of my past. And we talk weekly. And, you know, he can tell if I'm off for something. And he'll call me on and say, you better take a look at this. And, you know, we work through the steps together, and so he knows everything there is to know about me. So now I have safety nets to catch me now if I start going off. And go ahead.
I like that question because when we give our talk, you know, in front of, you know, large groups, it's like, you know, we had this childhood, there's trauma, we got sober, and here we are. And really what you can't explain in 20 minutes is that for me, I had a ton of therapy. I did have post-traumatic stress. I mean, I suffered a lot of trauma when I went to my biological parents. My biological mother was very physically and emotionally abusive. And all I can say without getting into a lot of detail is when I was in my early 20s, I had like my first breakthrough because I had a constant fear of her. And even though she was deceased, I was afraid to ever see her again. And then, I was not in a good marriage. It was pretty awful And I married someone who was actually my biological mother, Elaine, and he was extremely controlling. And once I got into Al-Anon, someone gave me the name of a woman who worked with a lot of people in recovery. It's called psychodrama. It's group therapy. And I did that for about 7 or 8 years. And I really learned a lot about myself by doing that. And also, the cool thing about being in a group is you learn from other people's work as well. And I met a lot of people with a lot of, you know, like scenarios I thought were worse than mine. And so I think, it's helped me to where I am today. And then, of course, by having a sponsor and working the steps, and I have a sponsee, and, you know, she helps me as much as I'm helping her. And so all that combined, I feel like I could live a pretty good life today. Mm-hmm. It's funny, though. John and I watched a movie Saturday night, and it was based on this woman's childhood, which was, you know, pretty traumatic because they lived, their father was an alcoholic. And after the movie, I was like, wow, that brought up some stuff for me. And, like, I cried a little, and John said, yeah, it brought up stuff for me. But today it's like, well, that's okay. Like, you are going to get triggered, and you get sad, you cry, but you move past it. But prior to being sober, that would, like, put me over the edge, and then I wouldn't want to feel. And that's when you decide, you know, or for me personally, to take a drink or a drug, because I didn't want to feel that feeling. But now I know they're just feelings, and they pass.
Yeah.
I mean, as addicts, why we chose our drugs of choice is we want to kill the pain. We don't want to feel anything, and that works really, really well to not feel anything. And but you know, with AA, it's like a giant living room. You know, we come to the meetings every day or every week or however often we go, and we learn how to live a normal life. And that's what's so great about AA. We can go anywhere in the world, and I could be in a meeting in a half an hour. And so it's an amazing group of individuals, and we learn from each other and how to deal with the world out there.
Well, I know, too, that I'm sure there's always that, I'm going to rephrase that. Is there always that thought in the back of your mind? I don't know if it's fear-based or other-based, as far as emotions are concerned, that I could fall off at any time, and this could all be gone again. Does that ever concern you?
Well, we see it every single day, and where we are in South Florida is like the recovery capital of the world, and a lot of deaths down here from the opioid overdoses. Mm-hmm. And so we see it every day. We see people, you could be sitting next to them the next day, they may not be there. Personally, I had my breakthrough 6 weeks into the program where I wrote a letter to my mother, and I didn't realize all the anger and resentment and the negative feelings I had towards her. And right there and then I was released from the addiction. And so I'm one of the lucky few. I found it early on what my trigger was. It was like my burning bush. And I haven't had the desire or compulsion to drink since that 6 week into the program. And here I am, you know, 19 years almost. And so I don't worry so much about that, but I worry about my thinking. And I worry about others because we see it every day. You can have 20 years of sobriety. And I had a friend who went out after 20 years last year at some point, and it just shocked the heck out of me. I was sponsoring a young man who was 29 years old, and he died last April on a heroin overdose, and he had a year sober. And it was that carfentanil drug that you're hearing about now, you know, the elephant tranquilizer drug. And I knew his family well. And that one really rattled me because people die from this disease every day. But personally for me, I'm not concerned about going back out. I don't have that fear, but I do for other people. And Adrian?
I mean, I don't have the fear either. You know, that's why going to meetings really helps.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's someone in my, we call home group, where you go regularly, who had 20 years, and now he's coming back in And so I don't have, if we go to a party or out to dinner and people are drinking, like, I have no desire to drink or to take a drug. I mean, the compulsion is gone. But I have a pretty, you know, there are people who go out and we say go out, which means they go back and use. And either a lot of, most of the time, they don't make it back in the rooms, as we say.
Yeah.
And the ones that do, I listen carefully because it's a good reminder that the disease, as we say, is, you know, sitting there waiting for you.
Well, we're talking here today with two incredibly prolific as well as supportive and encouraging individuals, John Lipscomb and Adrian Lugo, who are the co-authors, I should say, of The Painting and the Piano, An Improbable Story of Survival and Love. One of the things I'd like to touch upon when we come back from break is that transition, certainly the survival and love, but from survival. What we talk about on this program, of course, is that, well, I should say I talk about this, and I have my guests share their perspectives. Going from the survival mode to, and of course, there's no such word as thrival mode, but from just surviving to thriving, to enjoying the life that they've been given and moving forward. I would like to talk to the two of you about that when we get back from break. Here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, I'm Richard Dugan. Stay tuned. We have a whole lot more coming your way.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. A reminder that if you are listening to this program on the radio, you may not hear all of it because at 50 minutes, we bring this whole party to an end, and then we move on to a new program. But if you go to the website, richarddugan.com, you go to the archives or radio shows page where we post the podcasts, you can listen to the entire interview, whether it's an hour or an hour and 10 minutes or 20 minutes or what have you. It just depends upon what our guest's availability is. So we hope that you will do that. You will go to the website and listen to those interviews in their entirety because there's a lot more information that is contained at the end of these wonderful conversations that we're having today, for example, with the authors of The Painting and the Piano, An Improbable Love, A Story of Survival and Love. It's a love story, too. John Lipscomb and Adrian Lugos, thank you so much for staying with us here on the program. Let's talk about that aspect. Have you both, it sounds to me like at least you, John, and I would hope too, Adrian, you have maybe transitioned from the survival mode to that mode of thriving, of enjoying the life that God has given you in your lives to help others to reach that same state?
Well, you know, I think you hit on one thing. I think it's God-given for sure. And we talk a lot about, because our lives actually just skyrocketed once we got sober. And when I came into the program, I was basically broke. My house was almost in foreclosure. I had 3 DWIs. I hadn't paid the IRS in 3 years. My family was gone. My kids were gone. My wife was gone. My friends were gone. Everything was gone. And so when I came in, there wasn't much left, so I was starting at the bottom floor. And it was really interesting. About 5 years into the program, I met Adrian, and I started seeing a counselor because I wanted the relationship to work and to work well, and I was tired of failing at relationships. And he said, "You've gone way past surviving. You're thriving now," which is what you just said, so it was really interesting when you said that. And, you know, just survival, a lot of people can just survive and get by day, but my life and Adrian's life, it took off like a rocket ship. And, you know, I brought my business back, I contacted the IRS, you know, and made a payment plan and got even with them, and my friends came back in my life, and it just started growing and growing. My business grew, everything grew. I was doing things differently. I understood how the way normal people do things. And along the way, what I found that helped me more than anything else was giving back. and I started sponsoring a lot of guys. I started helping my outpatient hospital, recruit people. And I did things for other people that I was a self-centered, egotistical jerk, prior to getting sober. And all of a sudden I'd done a 180 and I become this person who helps everybody, which is like, I have a hard time even thinking about that, about myself right now. But so everything did skyrocket and I'm thriving. And then when we got to the point, I sold my business about 5 years ago, and Adrian and I looked at each other and go, well, maybe we should write the book, because the book is what we can do to help more people than anything else. And that's exactly what it's done. It's reached out and it's helped a lot of people. And that's going to do more than anything. And that makes me feel good. It doesn't matter if we get rich and famous off of this or not. We know what it's doing for people, and it's incredibly exciting. So my life has thrived, and you can probably hear the excitement in my voice, because from where I was pretty down and out, and there wasn't much hope left. I was spiritually, emotionally, and physically dead. And I have all that back. I have God in my life. I have Adrian in my life and all my friends and family, plus tons of friends and family from AA. And I have this amazing life. And we're talking to you, and we're both looking out at the ocean right now, on the beach. And, before we were, there wasn't much left. And so go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, we have an incredible life. I have an incredible life. Like John said, we both always wanted to be on the ocean, and that was always a lifelong dream. And, thriving is just being of service. Like I said, I'm sponsoring a woman right now, and she'll have 6 months tomorrow. And, and we talk about service in the rooms, but I think service is, like in life in general, it's like, if someone needs to get in front of you and, let their car in, or the person at the checkout counter, it's just being the best person that you can be every day. And there's really, to me, no better high than helping somebody else. And, but I learned that through, recovery. And, I have a great relationship with my three girls. They're, in their 20s, and they're a lot of fun, and we laugh, and we always have, like, group texts going on, and they adore John, and they get a kick out of him. And we have this thing every Christmas about who can hide the elf on the shelf and in the best spot. And it's, I didn't have any of that before, so it's just a great life.
Yeah, it's almost seems like the more we give back to other people and to help other people, and the more we thrive. And it's an amazing thing.
Now I'm gonna have to digress just a little bit. Would you please, I keep hearing the phrase, would you please describe for me what is Elf on the Shelf?
Oh. So it's, they made him a stuffed animal now. So it's this little elf, and you hide him. It's like a game, really. And
oh.
Yeah.
And every morning he shows up somewhere
different. Somewhere else. Yeah.
And last year I was able to sneak the elf on the shelf into the oldest daughter's suitcase. And when she got back to Chicago, she called me. She goes, "You got me."
Okay, I keep hearing the phrase, but I'm thinking, okay, I understand what elf on the shelf means. Have a stuffed elf sitting on a shelf, but I didn't realize it was a game. Okay.
Yeah, hide and seek, and where does the elf pop up next?
Yeah.
And it's pretty cute.
See, folks. You can learn all kinds of stuff here. I've learned something today. I can now go to sleep tonight knowing that I've at least learned one new thing.
Oh, I love it.
That's funny.
This whole process that the two of you have been through, obviously it continues on to this day, but in a much different mindset as well as soul set, if you will. And I'm curious about family. Now, John, you just ran down the laundry list of all the stuff and the people that you lost when you hit what Robert Bly in his book Iron John talks about when you hit catabasis or the bottom.
Right.
What about your families today? Where are you in that regard? with family and friends. Let me rephrase that. Family and friends of old as well as of new.
Okay. Well, so my siblings, I have a brother and a sister, and they are very protective of me, and they love what I've done and are amazed by what I've done, and they're fully back in my life. And like I said, they're very protective. My father also is back in my life. He actually went to 11 of the 12 outpatient weeks that he was asked to do, and that shocked me. There was nobody left in my life when I went through outpatient. He went to 11 of the 12 family meetings. Now, he's a drinker, and so, you know, after those 12 weeks, he kind of, you know, continued drinking, and I just choose not to be around it. Not that I want to drink or anything, but, you know, in the evenings, if he's going to drink, I'm not usually around that. But we have coffee, we have a great life together, and, you know, we play golf together and have lunch together, so that all worked out. A good friend of mine said once I got sober, he goes, wow, now you got all your 400 friends back. So all my friends from my past came back in my life. And I'm a different person, too, than they remember. I mean, I'm more responsible and accountable, and they can ask me to do anything, and I do. And I just actually just gave a eulogy at one of my best friend's funerals. I've known him since nursery school almost. And so all of those came back in my life. Hundreds and hundreds of new AA friends everywhere from, you know, St. Louis, where I was a daily meeting goer. There were days I went to two or three meetings a day, and those were all different meetings. And I have a lot of new friends down here in Florida. We've been down here for about 4.5 years. And so I have all these AA friends. So I'm not for lack of friends. Everywhere I go, they're new friends. By far and away, the saddest part of my story, Richard, is my kids, who are now 29 and 27, have never come back into my life. And I was 4 and 2, and, you know, when I left, and, you know, that's the consequences of the disease. And I still try and be the best person, the best father I can be. And I'm like Motel 6. I'll leave the light on for you, and hopefully they'll come back in my life someday. And, you know, I pray to God on a daily basis that they do show back up in my life. And I've tried to be the best person I can be, and right now it just doesn't seem to be going anywhere. And there have been times that have been good, and there are times that have been bad, and we're kind of one of those bad stages right now. And so I always tell, when I tell my story, it's, I got everything back in spades and much, much more than I deserve. But the saddest part of my story is my children, my son and daughter, have never come back into my life. And those are the consequences of my drinking. Yeah. And other than that, I mean, there's abundance of people in my life.
Adrian?
So for me, well, the first thing that happened was my biological mother died when I was around 15, which was the happiest day of my life. And that allowed me to go back and live with my foster parents, but I call them my parents, the Cons. And, you know, and then moving forward, my mom, I call my mom, my foster mom, my mom who raised me, you know, she passed away from breast cancer when I was pregnant with my youngest. And then my dad, when I say my dad, I mean my dad who raised me. He was died after I had a year of sobriety, and it was really cute because, you know, both my brothers that I was raised with were all very close. My middle brother he came from the same foster agency, and we never felt like we were different. We were a family, and that was that. And so my oldest brother lives in L.A., and him and my dad came to see me in treatment in Newport Beach. And my brother reminded me it wasn't my first detox. And my dad was so cute. He's like, oh, Adrian, you're going to lick this thing. And it was very cool because I had a year of sobriety. And, you know, I had time with him before he passed away in the hospital, which was a very spiritual moment for me. And then, you know, so I'm very close with them and my, you know, sister-in-law and my nephews. And then, you know, my biological sister is also just in and out of my life. She kind of came back in, and then the book came out and she was back out. And then recently she contacted me because her oldest child is struggling with an addiction, which I was floored that she wanted my help. And then, you know, I've reconnected with friends. Well, thanks to Facebook, I have all my high school friends back. And, you know, friends all over the country, sorority sisters. And then moving here has been really amazing for me because, you know, my parents left New York when I was, we left when I was a senior in high school. And so, and moved me to California where I got brutally teased about my New York accent. And so now living in South Florida, the majority of people are from the East Coast. So I feel like I've made a lot of friends, and actually some of them is, were people who were at these book clubs. And one even went to my high school in Long Island. So I've made a ton of new friends, and then, of course, my friends in recovery. So mm-hmm. it's a very full life.
That's exciting to know that, that especially for those listening who are concerned, obviously, because you begin to push away people when you're in that addictive state, I'm sure, and because people just don't want to be around you. It's like you're like an anchor of sorts. And so people are you know, wanting to, you know, distance themselves, understandably so. But at the same time, you know, there is hope for the future that, hey, you know, eventually maybe they'll come back and I may even get some new friends, some new acquaintances, some new family members, as it were. But it's not an easy road, I'm sure, to travel down. And I would have to say that the analogy I've used many, many times about choices probably applies even more in this situation, because the two of you, I'm sure, experienced this where you're walking down this road and there is a heavy fog and you can't see more than 10 or 20 feet ahead of you. However, you can see the white line of the shoulder of the road down there at your feet. So you just keep following that white line. And just keep going the direction you're going. And then all of a sudden the fog lifts and you see a fork. And suddenly you realize, oh, hey, maybe I could go that way. I don't know what's there. It could be anything, but it's got to be better than continuing down this. It might be, could be worse. But that's the whole thing about choices. And that's what we try to bring to our listeners is as many as possible. We lay out this giant smorgasbord, this table. Say, come, eat. What resonates with you, take. If it doesn't, don't touch it. If you don't like it, we don't want you to eat it. And so we, you know, we really encourage people to do just that, to find their place at the table and enjoy and do what they can to make their lives better, and in turn, maybe even make the lives of the people around them better as well. I've been through my struggles, but not from an addictive perspective, at least not as far as I can figure, not as far as I've been able to analyze and diagnose. But then I don't have the education for that. But I continue to move forward, and I'm so grateful that you two have taken the time to share your story with us and help those who are listening, including myself, to move forward. I mean, I know what Elf on the Shelf is all about now. So my life is complete today. But tomorrow, yeah, I have to learn something new. But again, I thank you both. It's just been extraordinary, and I'm most appreciative. I'm curious as to, I know that people are sitting there and they're listening and they're going, well, wait a minute. Hold it. Don't end the interview now. You haven't even addressed the most important question on the table. Talk about the painting and the piano. How do those two elements, specifically, obviously, in the context of this wonderful little odyssey, this journey that you take us on in the book, where do they come into play here?
Well, the painting and the piano was a title we came up with years and years ago before we even wrote the book. And the painting was Adrian's mother. Adrian's mother painted the painting, and it was sat in our foyer of our house. And the piano was my mother's, and it was in our house in the living room. So the piano basically has really negative, you know, bad meanings, you know, meanings for me. And, you know, it saw a lot of bad things happen where it was in the living room, the Christmas parties and the tree getting knocked over and all the alcoholism and the cigarette burns in the carpet. And so when my parents came to us and say they were getting divorced, I was 9 years old, the piano got wrapped up in padding and was put on a skid. And that it was put in storage. Well, that piano started following me around. It went from St. Louis. I moved to Texas for a while. I moved to Texas to two homes. Then I moved back to St. Louis. And it was sat in that house. Then it moved to another house in St. Louis. And Adrian and her girls moved in with me. And Adrian said, well, what's that thing wrapped up in the basement? I said, well, that's a piano. And she goes, well, why don't you put it up? Like, it had never occurred to me that you're really supposed to put a piano up. You know, I thought it was just going to follow me to my grave wrapped up. It never occurred to me. So I was at work one day, and I came home, and I turned the corner, and all of a sudden there was the piano. It was up in the living room, and around the edge of the piano, this gold etching that's, like, burned into my brain. And I saw that etching, and all of a sudden my life stopped, and my memories went flashing back to when I was a little boy, you know, in that house. And the piano sat there and watched all these crazy parties and the alcoholism and what all transpired, and it's kind of a scary, you know, black, dark feeling. And about a day later, we decided to hang up the painting in the foyer, and Adrian was coming down the stairs, and I could see the smile on her face, and it had really great memories of her and her mother, and when her mother was painting the painting, and so I remember looking at Adrian right there and then, and because people had told us we should write a book and tell our story. And we said, yeah, we don't have time. We don't know how to do it. And I said, you know, if we ever do write this book, we should call it The Painting and the Piano. Mm-hmm. And we both kind of laughed and chuckled it off. And we really never thought anything about it until, gosh, almost 5 years after that, when we actually started writing after I sold my business. And we started writing the book, and we said, well, what are we going to call it? I said, well, we have the title, The Painting and the Piano. And it has stuck since that time, and everybody seems to like it for the most part. But that's where the title came from.
Well, your piano turned out a whole lot better than mine, because my wife and I, when we moved to Santa Barbara, we didn't even think about it. We thought, well, in a few days, we will move it into the house itself. We had to go up 4 steps. And we thought about it, we would have let the moving company put it in the house right then and there. And unfortunately, we moved here in 2006. It has been sitting outside in all the weather, even covered with a tarp from time to time. And it is not, I don't believe it is even recoverable. Maybe the hardware, maybe. But it's just, so as far as I'm concerned, the painting and the pile of piano parts is that would be the title of my book. Kind of sad. But that's pretty cool. And I have to say that I'm in the process myself of completing a particular work I'm doing. And I'm looking everywhere for these sketchbooks of mine. I seem to have misplaced them, that I've drawn stuff over the years, and I was thinking there are some drawings that I might want to incorporate. And I know how important that can be from time to time for folks to want to incorporate into their lives, into the things that they're doing, these wonderful symbols, of their lives and where they've been and all of that. And that, to me, I mean, I would assume that that's pretty memorable. It's kind of a cool thing for the two of you, in spite of, again, what the two of you have been through with your families, in terms of the process that you went through is what I'm referring to.
Right.
That's got to be something that's a little... A little more of a challenge, if you will, to incorporate because of all of the memories, all of the past that goes along with these things.
Right. Well, you know, they both articles, you know, our objects start out with our mothers, you know, and so that's the prologue of the book is, you know, about our mothers.
Yeah.
And you can't underestimate the significance of the bond that a child has with their mothers.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So before we wrap up this program, and again, I thank you so much for sharing, is there any one message in particular that you would like to leave, whether it's in the context of this interview or that they would also maybe find woven within the pages of the painting and the piano?
For me, I would hope anyone listening who's struggling with addiction and feels helpless and hopeless to reach out to someone. Clearly, there are so many, you know, numbers and places to reach out. They could even reach out to us. There's our website, and we have our phone numbers available. You know, there's no shame in addiction. It's a disease. And there's always, always hope. And so I guess that would be my main message.
Yeah, and my main message, I'm going to kind of tag on to your fog, is that, you know, to walk through that fog and then you get to the fork in the road, is you got to have a tremendous amount of faith and trust the faith and trust jumping off the ledge. And you'll be okay. You know, God will catch you. And show you the right way. So have faith, and don't be run your life by fear. You know, let it be run by faith.
You know, you used an interesting phrase there, because for me, when my wife and I moved here to Santa Barbara, that was sort of the phrase that we, I will say, lived by, if you will. When we first lost our jobs in the Phoenix area back in 2006, my wife came to me and asked me, what are we going to do? I'm afraid. I don't know what we're going to do. And I don't know why, maybe because of what I said to her, but I didn't have any fear. I mean, I didn't have a job. We didn't have any money coming in, but we had this small little nest egg that would keep us going for a little while until we found those other jobs. But I says, you know, of all of the personal growth programs I've been through, all of the self-help books I've read and the interviews that I've done, on and on and on, I says the one message that constantly comes back is jump and trust. And I said, and that's what we did. And that's when we made the decisions that we made that have brought us here to this day and this conversation with both John Lipscomb and Andrea Lugo, and we're talking about, of course, the painting and the piano. Again, I want to thank the both of you for joining us here on the program. This has just been a delight. I am grateful for your being a part of Tell Me Your Story, as well as the part of the lives of the people that you have touched. And I cannot imagine the impact that you have made on the lives of, I'm going to say, millions of people, not specifically through this program, but through the people that you have touched and helped. You have no idea that those are the stories that are really incredible as well, of the lives you've touched that have gone on to do some incredible things, some awesome things. And I think that is also very noteworthy in this context, because we don't know what impact we're going to have. We really don't. And we've got to begin to understand ourselves that we make a difference. We may not see it today. We may not see it tomorrow, but we do. And the two of you, you're making a profound difference in the lives of people in your community who then they go out into the rest of the world. And they make a difference that they probably would not have if it hadn't been for the two of you and other folks like you. So my hat's off to you.
Well, thank you so much.
I want you folks to go to the website, and if you would please tell me, the website, is it, have I have this correct, thepaintingandthepiano.com?
Just paintingandpiano.com, paintingpiano.com, no and.
Paintingpiano.com. Folks, check it out. We really hope that you will. I think that you will be greatly surprised and encouraged as well. And if you know someone, even better, if you know someone who is struggling through these kinds of things, these addictions, and you're wanting to get them some help, well, here's a good place to start. Yeah, you know,
Facebook too, Richard. We're on Facebook, and they could join there. And our numbers are on the website, and the books at Amazon and you know, Barnes and Noble and places like that.
Well, fantastic. Once again, I want to thank you so much for joining us. And by the way, should you ever find yourself, I can never remember how far it is, 3,000 or 5,000 miles, to the west, here in Santa Barbara, the area along the Central Coast, we would love to have you in studio to continue this conversation.
We're going to be out there in September, so we'll look you up.
Fantastic. We will love to have you in here to follow up and see what's next on the horizon, hopefully a sequel to The Painting and the Piano and an improbable story of survival and love. And then finally, I'm going to have the two of you answer three final questions as we wrap up our program. And again, my thanks to my guests, John Lipscomb and Andrea Lugo, for joining us here on the program, authors of The Painting and the Piano. First, John, to you.
Hey.
Who is John Lipscomb?
A changing and evolving human being.
Who is Andrea Lugo?
A kind, warm person who's always looking for adventure and meeting new people.
To Andrea, what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
Just really continue to help people through our book and sponsoring people and just getting the word out that there's just no shame in addiction. And also, you know, there's no, if you're in a bad marriage, there's always a solution to every problem and there's always hope.
And John, what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
Well, similar to Adrian's, I think, you know, help as many people as we possibly can and to give them, you know, the courage to, you know, jump off the ledge and to have faith that everything will work out. And, you know, really, if we can do it, so can you. And that's why we wrote the book. There's nothing special about us, you know, so if we can do it, so can you.
Yeah. I might disagree with you there, but but that's okay. That's what we're all about here. Finally, to John, what is your life's purpose?
To stay sober and help other people.
And Adrian, what is your life's purpose?
I'd probably have to say the same thing, to be of service to others, and I can only do that by staying sober and being the best person that I can be.
Well, again, we thank you for being of service here on this program and joining us and sharing your story. I do encourage people to go to Painting and Piano and the Piano, paintingandthepiano.com. That is the website. They're also on Facebook, as they've stated. And get in touch if you need some support, some help. I am sure that they can and will, or they will also direct you to folks around the country. I'm sure that you folks are connected nationally as well as internationally to assist and support folks going through their process. So again, we thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard. We appreciate it.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal.